Who would you gather on your ideal heist team? And we'll come back to that. Welcome to the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast. My name is Don Bishop, and I write as T.S. Pedramon. Today, I bring you an interview with military thriller author Dan Kemp. And we had our conversation out at Confinement Con. I like to pronounce it Confinement, but, you know, when I was there on the ground, other people weren't pronouncing it that way. But so Confinement Con in Lebanon, Tennessee, and this was on March 1st when we had our conversation. And, other than that, I don't really have announcements today other than, we'll jump right into our weekly book giveaway. So 2 episodes ago, and I'm looking at my notes, you see me looking off camera. 2 episodes ago, I asked what is the most formidable military in a fictional universe, or you could answer, if you could choose, what enchanted gift would you receive from a wizard for your birthday? Or for whatever occasion. And there were some answers that I shared last week in the podcast. The winner was actually none other than today's guest, Dan Kemp. The magic number was 787, and his guess of 679 was the closest, even though it was over 100 away. But hey, you know, it works. Now, last week's question of the week was... your choice, teleportation or plant growth powers. What would you choose and why? So I got some good answers for this, and I was surprised that there was more leaning toward magical plant growth, at least in the discussions. It looks like most people chose the teleportation power, but there was a discussion in my Discord server, and as people talked more about it and like what you could do with it, there was more leaning towards this. Plant growth powers. So, Debbie said, teleportation, having seen kudzu and other things grow, to visit my children and other things, can I use it for travel if I've never been there? And I'm like, yeah, sure. Green Hilda, and these are, I'm either using names or screen names, you know, as whatever the case may be. And most of these are from, my Discord server. There is one from Facebook, but So Green Hilda said, I would choose magical plant growth for various uses. Transportation, like a self-driving car. Like, that's some imagination. Creating buildings, like Debbie said, because she mentioned that after she gave her answer. Protection in a fight, like throw up a quick cage or a wall. To bind up enemies, grow food in a hurry, maybe grow food out of season. Werecat said, my initial thought was teleportation, so we could go visit family easily. But I don't know if I would be able to take people with me, or if I'd only be able to teleport myself. See, I didn't really give exact parameters for these powers. I kind of imagine you could take a couple of people with you. Where was I? Or if I'd only be able to teleport myself. I eventually decided that growing plants is a more useful power overall anyway. I could easily grow privacy fences, tree houses, my own home, and drastically cut down on how much we spend on groceries. Privacy fences. Not a bad idea. J.F. Postumus said, if you can take others and things with you, teleportation. If it's only for one person, plant growth. Especially since you can have one heck of a garden year-round. Not to mention, if you can grow it, you can do the opposite. Bye-bye problem weeds. Oh, wait. That could be fun, especially if people you don't like have gardens. Just make their gardens not grow at all. All their plants and grass just seems sad and sick. Okay, moving on. August said, probably go with teleportation. Unless you can only arrive naked, then I'd probably go with plant growth. Natalie said teleportation, travel faster and go anywhere. Tilly said, I'd say teleportation because that would just be amazing for one too. You can never be like three. Sorry, I did not read this beforehand. So you would never be like, you could pop up on your boyfriend or spouse and make sure they're not cheating. That's a good point. You could do a lot of great things with it, and I can go to way more book signings. I would definitely get to travel a lot more and quicker, so that would be amazing for me, and maybe that would give me the motivation I need to start writing my first book. I shared a meme the other day, by the way. It said, I didn't make it, you know, I found it. It said that I was wandering and I wasn't paying much attention to where I was going, and then I found myself in the library of unwritten books. I wasn't able to read any of mine, but I read a few of yours, and they were really good. Like, you should write that. Anyway, so there's the motivation. So I read your unwritten book, and it was really good, so you should write it. Okay, so the winner for this week is still undecided. Because it's still open while I record this. It's open until I publish this. So when you hear it, it is decided. But as I record this, I don't know who that is yet. Because as close as somebody is, somebody could still get closer. Because I haven't looked at, you know, maybe somebody guessed the exact number. But I don't pay attention to what numbers people guess until the end. And then I notice and see who won. Okay, so this week's magic number was 723. So whoever guessed closest to that wins the book giveaway for the week. And you can choose from the menu at grandhill.media/prizes. And the magic letter of the week was S. So if the winner guessed R, S, or T, then that person can get two books instead of just one. Now, I did notice that out of nine numbers so far, because we've done this nine times at least that I wrote down in this book, and I think I started from the beginning in this little notebook that I have. And after writing down nine times, there have been four within the 700s. And likewise with the magic letters, which have been IROUBHRTS, meaning that four times, if the winner had guessed S, they would have won. So I'll show you right there. That's the first week. You can see on the screen if you're watching the video. And yeah, so I'll give it another chance. It could just be a small sample size. You know, this is a small sample size. It's only nine. But if this week's number is in the 700s, and if this week's letter is R or S or T, then next week I will use a different random number or letter generator. But you won't know that until next week. I'll know that in a couple of minutes, but we'll give it one more chance. And yeah, so I will now go ahead and get the magic number for the coming week generated. I've got my, I don't have anything to write it down. Do I? Does this pen work? Probably. Oh, it does. Okay, good. I wasn't sure if this pen worked. Okay. The random number is... Boop! That's the number. And I try to, write it fast. So you don't see how many digits it is. Because it could be a single digit or a double digit number. But then while I'm trying to write it fast, I mess it up, so I have to go back and screw it. So you can't tell anyway. So there's the random number. And here comes the random letter. There we go. All right. So those are there for next week. And I say week, I've missed a couple of weeks this year. What with my tour through Dallas and Salt Lake and Tennessee, I did not keep every single week, for a podcast episode being published. But I've been fairly close. Okay. So we have a new magic number for this coming week and a letter of the alphabet. And here is the question. And this is kind of inspired by, well, this is inspired by my conversation with Dan Kemp, because he writes military thrillers. And he talked about kind of doing a heist or a bust. And, okay, so this week's question is, if you had to assemble a team for the ultimate high-stakes heist, which three fictional characters would you choose? And what are you trying to steal? Nobody's talking to you, Bixby. Okay, pardon me. My watch thought I was talking to it. Okay, so tell me, like, who's your pick? Three characters. You're going on a heist. And who are they? From any universe. What are you trying to steal? And why? Like, is it a lot of money? Is it a magical artifact? Is it your sister's diary? I don't know. Like, you tell me, and we'll give the winner a free book next week. So, on to the interview. Before we go on, this was recorded at Confinement Con, and being in a public space, there was a lot of background noise, and I used Descript to remove the background noise. So if our voices sound a little funny, it's because it's been digitally enhanced or modified, whatever, so that you can hear us more clearly. And most of the conversation is more clear because that background noise is removed. There may be a few words that are just a little funny, but whatever. Yeah. Thanks for coming. Enjoy the interview. And remember to answer my question of the week. Tell me who's on your heist team. You can tweet it. You can email it. You can Facebook comment on the post I'm going to put up there. You can drop in my Discord and read all these answers and the conversation behind them, because there was conversation behind them that I didn't get to. Yeah, see you next time. And enjoy the interview. This is with author Dan Kemp. And when we talk at the end where to find him on the web, I'm going to drop those links in the show notes or the video description.
All right, so here I am with author Dan Kemp. Now, Dan, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and how you came into writing and your author journey.
Anybody who reads for as many years as I have is inevitably going to retort to Branchman. When you pull in so many words into your brain, they pile up. And like when you stack too much mulch, it starts fermenting and it heats. And eventually something catches fire. And then all of a sudden you think, hey, just because I read, I can write. A whole lot of people believe this, and a lot of them are wrong. So far, I'm not doing that badly. I have dozens of devoted fans.
Dozens is in that. That's
dozens is an improvement. Good, yeah. Dozens is a good start. May even be more than that, but
because you start out with like your mom and. That's even debatable.
My mom has not read any of my stuff. To be honest, mom would be slightly horrified if she learned some of my stuff. My aunt, on the other hand, who's 82 years old and somewhere to the left of Vladimir Lenin, on the other hand, is an enthusiastic fan, and I do not know why. She is 100% not my usual reader demographic. If I had to pick my reader demographic, 35 to 55 years old, gun owner, usually military veteran, usually combat experience in Iraq or Afghanistan. That is my core reader demographic right there. Because, as I'll explain later, my first published work was an outgrowth of somebody else's work who'd used me as a redshirt character and then invited all of us who'd been redshirted in that book to write our characters. Actually, the funny thing is that book's been out for 8 years now, and I am the only one of us to have actually done it. Well, it's a funny little place.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was, to steal a line from Larry Hama, I was a very strange child who grew into an even weirder adult. History major, rotsy kid, rotsy cutbacks, ended up enlisting after graduation, told myself I'd go to OCS later and simply never did for a couple of reasons. NCOs have a hell of a lot more fun for starters. And also, from an intellectual and moral perspective, the army that I had been taught how to be a lieutenant in didn't really exist anymore. So instead, I sort of reinvented myself as the alleged don of the Ingfor Mafia, which is all a rumor. There is no such thing.
Yeah. Well, yes.
That's our story, and we're sticking to it. So after getting out of the service, after a couple of career-ending injuries, well, career-altering, then career-ending, I was contracting, and then I went civil service, and that's my day job. But what a lot of these jobs had in common was a lot of dead time. So I've still got my noses in books after all these years, and reading. And then my buddy Seth turned me into a character, and I said, hey, I can write then. I actually wrote something else first that may see the light of day one day. Can't tell that story yet. That story is sitting in somebody's inbox.
So, kind of to put it in my words, what I'm taking away is your author journey has been shaped by your military experience.
100%.
Okay. And you write specifically like in military sci-fi or.
I started out.
And now, is this sci-fi like you?
No, this isn't sci-fi at all. Okay. This happens in Las Vegas, like literally last month.
Okay.
A whole bunch of that novel happens in Vegas at the SHOT Show 2025. That is how bleeding edge current events I write. Did I mean to write in that genre? Not at all. Mm-hmm. I started out thinking, man, I'm going to do sword and sorcery and military sci-fi, and I'm going to do this. And instead, I started writing what became the first Athenaeum novel, Door Number 3. And it hit to an extent that all of a sudden I got instantly bugged. Where's the sequel?
No, yeah.
I hadn't really thought that far ahead yet. That's actually the sequel.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, it turned into the series that has eaten the rest of my writing goals. It's fun. I love writing them. I write other short stories in between, and I have writer's block on the Athenaeum main sequence. But it's not at all what I thought I was going to write, which also wasn't what my publisher thought he was going to be publishing. Canon Publishing is known for being a military sci-fi press, a little bit of a fantasy press. And all of a sudden, I drag him kicking and screaming into the military thriller market, but it's sold.
Yeah.
And it's the reason it's called the writing business. Sometimes you have to give the people what they want, even if it isn't what you want to give them. So, we will get to the story of how Athenaeum got published, because in itself, that is a story with a certain amount of sight gags and whatnot. It's a good story.
So you're pointing out the business aspect,
yes,
where you try to make money, so you're kind of obligated to give the customer what he wants.
I mean, I could have sat back after Door Number 3 came out. I could have turned around, done a 90-degree turn, and started writing a story about funny animals that, you know, talk to each other or hit each other with sticks or whatever. But that isn't what people were screaming for. People were screaming for an Athenaeum sequel. And all of a sudden, I have to produce one, Writing the first novel took me 4.5 years on and off, and I got Doubling Down done in right about a year.
Mm.
This could be described as somewhat stressful.
Yeah.
And the sequel will be out, the third book will be out in right about the same, progression.
Yeah, and I've heard for bands or musicians of whatever type, like they'll have this great first album, and then the second album will be unimpressive because the first album they had all their lives up until that point to write those songs. Well, the second album, okay.
John Bon Jovi.
Give us like 10 or 15 songs.
John Bon Jovi said that in an interview once. He's like, I had my entire life to write the first album. Then I had to get the second one done in a year. And he said it was a lot harder than it looked. Of course, look at Bon Jovi's career. They escalated as they went. Rather than say my beloved Guns N' Roses, who had one really good album and then just sort of dropped off the roller coaster hill. And that's that. But if you have a pattern and you know what you're trying to write, it makes it easier. To quote Angus Young of AC/DC, an interviewer once asked him, isn't it true you guys have 11 albums that all sound the same? And Angus looked at him and said, that's a load of crap. We have at least 12 albums that all sound the same. You write to your pattern. You get your style, you refine your style, and you keep producing in that.
So yeah, I mean, that's kind of to some extent, that's what genre is. Mm-hmm. That's reader expectations.
Even within genre, though, genre is...
broad.
Even one particular genre is a Chinese buffet.
Yeah, yeah.
Of things. And everybody's got their favorite thing on that buffet. You will have your Tom Clancy fans, even in military thrillers, you'll have the Tom Clancy fans and Tom Clancy readers. And I'm of two minds on Tom, but that's another whole story. Then, because anybody who writes in the military thriller space, we live in that man's shadow, despite him having been dead for
40 years it now?
Dead for 18 years now. It's a rhetorical joke.
It's while you do the math.
Pause
the world while I do math.
Like, wait a second. It's like, I have a lot of stories that start, it was a few years ago, and then I stop and realize, wait a second, that was at least a decade. When getting old will do that to you. But.
Yep.
Everybody has their favorite thing on that buffet. You'll have your Tom Clancy fans, or your Stephen Hunter fans, or your Jack Higgins fans. Or all up and down that buffet, there's something that they want off the buffet in the genre.
Uh-huh.
Because they don't like the taste of that other stuff. They want that. And they want an all-you-can-eat buffet of that.
Yeah.
So sometimes you have to keep giving them that.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about, you write military thriller.
Mm-hmm.
So what is this book and its prequel? What is the series? What's your treatise?
Well, when I first started writing it, it didn't have a title. And actually, it was my eventual publisher who came up with the title and actually was the one who named the company. I simply referred to it as the company or the firm or whatever, all of which were said we couldn't really go with those because there were two obvious euphemisms for the CIA. Despite this being a private contracting firm, no formal government connections except for...
yeah.
Here's your money. Keep working. Here's your money. Keep working. How I started writing that is a task. My buddy Seth Bailey used me as a character in his third novel, Edge of the City, which came out in 2016. Mm-hmm. He invented my fictional alter ego as the professor, which really was one of my call signs in the army at one point, only it was not meant as a compliment. The army can frown on obnoxious nerds.
Uh-huh.
And that would be me. So, a couple years after that, I was talking to my friend Jennifer.
Uh-huh.
Jennifer was summa cum laude at Harvard, undergrad and MBA. Gorgeous little Korean chick. Whole lot of smart, whole lot of crazy. To say she has issues would be the understatement of the day.
Gesundheit.
Yes. Krogut. Issues. And she makes a phone number a year. She's an, you know, she's an investment banker and stockbroker, makes tons of money. She's trapped in a life that she does not particularly enjoy. And one day she's cussing to me about her boss and her boss's boss. And I said, tell you what, Jennifer, I'll make you a deal. I will get my hands on a whole bunch of money and I will hire you to come work for me as my money manager. And that way you don't have to work for that guy anymore. She calmly answered, Dan, you're a disabled vet who makes about 35 grand a year taken. Where are you going to find enough money to need a money manager, let alone afford me? I said, well, I can either hit Powerball. And she said, I'm not even going to dignify that with an answer. She said, or I can figure out where one of those 20-foot shipping containers full of drug cartel money is sitting on any particular night. Make a dozen phone calls, put band back together. We do a couple of nights of rehearsals. We go off, we grab a 20-foot container. And then you get to help me wander maybe $500 million. And she just stared at me. She said, wait a second, you know how to do that? I said, yeah. An infantry raid is an infantry raid. I don't care if you're hitting an Iraqi Army headquarters bunker. I don't care if you're blowing up an enemy supply dump. Or if you're grabbing a 20-foot shipping container full of somebody's illegal money. It's still intelligence, reconnaissance, near-site security, far-site security, support by fire, assault phase, time on target, time on target, time on target extraction. That's it. That's all it is. I'm glossing over some of the doctrinal fine print in there, but that's the process.
Yeah.
The dance is the dance. And she's like, wait, why haven't you done that yet? I said, one, partly I'm lazy. Two, I don't know where the money is. If I was in a position to know where the money was, I would be much more sorely tempted. And then I thought about it. And I remembered Seth's words of, you guys need to go write your character. Yo, take your story, take your characters and write your own stories. And all of a sudden it hit me like a freight train. And I thought, oh crap, I can write this.
Okay.
And I reached down and I put my phone down and I pulled out my laptop, opened new document in Word, double space, and I started typing. And I started typing. And I started typing. And anybody who reads a lot and has had delusions of being able to write has got 40 or 50 abandoned writing projects that are like 3 or 4 paragraphs of scraps. A week later, I had like 15,000 words and I just kept rolling. The material was there. It was like getting messages from an alternate timeline of my life and telling the story. It's like, wait a sec, it's just flowing and flowing and flowing and flowing. And I get like 70,000 words. And I thought about it for a minute. I'm like, why am I wasting my time on this? And nobody's going to publish this. This is no good. This is crap. Nobody's going to want to read this. So send it to a couple of friends of mine. My friend Chris Dedeau should get all the credit in the world for this. Dedeau's an editor at Rack and Tour now, but he's a retired Air Force bird colonel. And Chris and I were grad school classmates at Norwich up in Vermont. Funny thing is, it's an online program. Nobody really saw each other the whole time. He was a section behind us, so we didn't have any classes together. But we go up there for the residency week on campus, and we all have our name tags, so we finally get to see our online classmates after all this time. And I see Christopher Dedeau, and I looked and said, wait a second. Sci-fi author I know used that name for one of his space squadron commanders. And Chris turns, he says, oh, far out, man. Where do you know John Ringo from? And we started talking and we clicked and we've been buddies ever since. So Dedeau was one of the people I sent the story to. Didn't even have a time at that point. And he blazed through it in about 2 days. He said, if you don't finish this, I will kill you. I said, really? He said, yes, man. It's that good. Keep going. And I said, why? He said, it's a classic. He said, you started out trying to write like a military techno thriller. He said, but it's a classic heist movie. You wrote a Guy Ritchie movie with a different accent. He said, I read this novel, which of course is, you know, told first person. He said, I hear it read in Jason Statham's voice, like Snatch or Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. And he's just talking his way through the story. Only I hear it in that London Cockney accent. I'm like, which is funny because the professor's probably got a messed up half Southern accent like I do. But, you know, him sharing much of my biography, he said, I don't care. I hear Jason Statham. I'm like, okay, fine.
Never mind.
So I keep writing, and I keep writing through that summer and get into over the winter. And there's some breaks and some gaps and breaks and gaps and whatnot. And I was sitting at about 125,000 words with a couple of big gaps in the story.
Yeah.
I don't write in order. I write a piece. I write another piece. I write another piece. Then I make extensive use of the cut and paste function to put the pieces where I want them.
Yeah.
Split. I'm like, I use paragraphs like a demented kid with Legos. And I take them and I move them around where I want them. And if I don't like where I want them, I break them apart and I move them around again. And finally, I get something that looks like a novel. Then I have the process that I call welding up the deal, welding up the gaps, where you just go in, you fill in your transitions or
yeah.
move your chapter breaks around, because all of a sudden you have one chapter that's longer than most short stories. You have another chapter that's like three or four paragraphs. You go back through and you rebalance everything and you stack it all up. And you weld it all up and you grind it down and you put a coat of paint on it so it looks like you'd actually planned it. It comes out looking like a much more polished product than it ever did in the process.
Right.
It's like shipyard ugly. It's like rust and exposed welds and everything. And, you know, you take all that and you just, you know, but you mix it.
Yeah. Yeah. And
so I was most of the way there. And I go to LibertyCon's rage day in 22, once LibertyCon started again after the lockdowns. And my friend James Cochran used to run the LibertyCon rage day. And COVID, make a long story short, COVID got injigious. And I pull up to the range, and his wife has carried a picture of him around, you know, just so he's there one last time. And, you know, and then this little dark-haired guy with his U.S. Army veteran ball cap and his crossed rifles and his sergeant first class rank comes walking up to Ginger and says, hey, Ginger, I'm going to go and get out of here. I don't know any of these people. They're all shooting newer guns than I've got. I'm just going to split. I looked at him. I said, first, you know me now. Secondly, I brought this, and this, and I brought too much ammo not to share. So how about you get yourself back over there on that firing line? You're going to help me shoot some of this stuff off, and we're going to have a good time, all right? And he just looks at me. He's like, okay. And he turned and he went back over to the firing line. I backed my truck up, and, you know, I'm unloading this, that, and the other thing. And he said, you ever fire a Garand? And he's like, no, I've always wanted to. I brought an M1 carbine. I said, I got three of them. And, you know, so we're starting with the Grand, and, you know, ding, bang, 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 bing. So we're like three clips through the Grand. He looks over at me, he says, is this your first LibertyCon? I'm like, no, I've been to a few of them. I said, this isn't even my first range day. He said, well, I guess I haven't run into you yet at any of them. And I said, yeah, well, he said, you written anything? I said, I've got one short story that's turned in that hasn't seen the light of day yet. And then I've got this one novel manuscript that's 90% done that I have no idea what to do with. He looks at me and said, you know, I'm a publisher, right? And I looked at him. I said, no offense, man. I have no idea who the hell you are.
You know.
He says, oh, John Holmes. Please don't Google that name. You remember the old PowerPoint Ranger Facebook page? Yeah. He said, that was me before my chain of command told me to stop writing. Oh, okay. I know who you are now. He said, well, then I started writing sci-fi, and then I started Canon Publishing, you know, because it was artillery, as my project to write, you know, to publish my own stuff that it had a label. And I said, well, is it just you? He said, well, I've got a couple of other writers now, but we're really, really small. I said, oh, okay. He said, so talk to me about this novel of yours. I said, I don't know. It's not sci-fi. It's basically a thinly veiled Kelly's Heroes ripoff. He looked at me and said, that's one of my favorite movies. It's one of a lot of people's favorite movies. Keep talking.
Mm-hmm.
We start discussing the book and everything, and he nods and nods. He said, you got a copy of it with you? I said, I think I got a copy in my email. It's about 90% of the 90% that's done. He said, send it to me real quick. What's your number? Whip out the phone.
Yeah.
Email, you know, email it to him. He's like, got it. He's like, all right, man, I got to get out of here. I got to get down the hill and across the time zone line. I'm on a panel at 1 o'clock or whatever it was. So we had to skedaddle out of there. He said, yeah. Oh, before we leave, I'm doing a meeting tomorrow for prospective authors. I think it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I need you there. Okay. So I get down to the con a couple hours later after I shot off what I felt like shooting, get down there and we're walking through the con and I see him every now and then. He's sort of looking at me and looking at his phone and snickering and giggling. Finally, I run into him at the meeting the next day and he pulls me off to the side after the meeting, which was kind of a very general advice session. And he'd look at a manuscript here or there. He grabs me off to the side and directs me off to the side of the and he said, look, you wrote it. I'm only 4 chapters in. You wrote it first person, which is an extremely limiting narrative for an author. And I'm sitting here thinking, please don't tell me I have to rewrite all of it because I won't. I just won't do it. I'll write something else.
Yeah.
But he kept talking. He said, but I've met you and you write the way you talk. So having met you, it makes perfect sense.
Leave him alone.
And he thinks about it for a second. He said, oh, hell with it. Let's do this, man. Somebody will buy it. And I thought, I just sold my first novel. And then I thought about it for a second and realized I have to finish my first novel. Because this is a family-friendly podcast, I will not repeat what I was thinking at that moment. It was the Sistine Chapel ceiling of profanity. So I stumble out that little side hole out of the room, make that little exit by the LibertyCon smoke deck that a whole bunch of people probably will remember. And I go out there and I cut and light, and you get going. And I'm just sort of nervously puffing away going, how am I going to finish this? How am I going to finish it? And Holmes walks by. He's like, oh, yeah, I need it in a month. And I'm puffing. And this little brown-haired guy comes walking by, got a bottle of it. And he said, man, you look like you need a drink. I said, yes, I do. And he pours me a little bit and proceeded to explain the somewhat exotic bottle of Dallas, the old-made bourbon that he had with him. He's like, the red wine infusion sounds weirder than it, you know, sounds weirder, but it tastes good. Here, try that one. And this is pretty good. Topped me back off. I'm sipping, and I calmed my nerves down a little bit, and I thought, okay, I can do this. I can do this. I can do this. And I got it done, and we got it turned in.
Yeah.
And then the copy editor at Canon is a retired bird colonel named Bill Oma. He's very good at moving commas around. He got a couple of chapters in and said, has this been through a DOD security review yet? Because it probably should. And I'm like, wait, no, hold on. When I got out in 09, the last NDA I signed was I only had to get nonfiction reviewed. And secondly, there's zero actual classified in that book because either I made it up or I stole it out of G.I. Joe comic books. And Bill's like, no, dude, no. We really need to get this looked at. I used to work in the office next door to those guys, and they're not fun to deal with. Make a long story short, or try, the novel gets turned in. And that turned into 6 months of ping pong going bing, 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 back and forth because they're complaining about unit names, places, dates, and all sorts of other stuff out of history books. And finally achieved a level of detente with the retired colonel who runs that office because he used to teach history at West Point, and I could footnote all of it.
Uh-huh.
I didn't actually put the footnotes in the book, though I could have, but everything he complained about, I'm like, nope, sourced it here. Nope, ain't sourced it here. Did you have to mention this guy? No, he wrote a book. I've got it. See? Here's my copy of his book. And then, once the DOD review was underway, he also offered it up to NSA, CIA, and DIA for their review. He called the document review office at CIA, and CIA just said, did this guy ever officially work for us? No. Then we don't care. Huh? One, he doesn't officially know anything, and two, we're as backed up as you are, so we don't care. NSA also told them the same. I don't know if they ever actually bothered calling DIA, but I used a lot of people's names in vain in the first book because the first book is all the background material and historical world building that gets us to where we are.
Yeah.
There's conspiracy theory stuff. There's stolen Nazi gold. There's the looting of Asia by the Japanese in World War II. There's the story of the stolen Nazi gold getting shipped out of Europe down to the Mediterranean to the Suez on neutral flag tankers and getting sold to the Arabs because the Arabs were flush with Western dollars and pound sterling from wartime oil sales. And Arabs are traditionally minded. They trust gold way more than they trust pretty paper with somebody else's picture on it. So got to remember that. So I'm weaving all these threads together to a story that's basically a glorified bank robbery. But there's all of this. It happens in the context of all of this other historical and quasi-historical and historical fiction stuff that gets us to where we are and gets us to the book. And then the cliffhanger ending that I could either call it good there or I left it open for sequels. And a couple of the initial reviewers just said, yes, he clearly set up the sequels in the next book. And then I nodded and said, great, I guess I better start writing then because I don't think I have a lot of choice. And I just kept going and going and going and going. And it's a process. And I've created I have dozens of devoted fans now, hopefully. So it seems to work. I mean, I have a little scrap, and it's an artifact of my writing process. If I have, while I'm going through and cutting and pasting, moving, if I have a chunk that doesn't really fit, I break it off, I save it as something else. So I have little, what I call scrapyard files, all the way up to Athenaeum Volume 9. Okay. Should I live so long to write them all? I don't know. But the idea is there. The ideas are kind of there.
And is your series more, like, is it a long arching story with a, or is it more kind of episodic where you've set things up for future episodes, but each one is its own self-contained story?
Each one is its own self-contained story, but at the same time, it builds on prior episodes that I throw in enough backstory and exposition that you could pick up a later volume and not be as confused. But sometimes the narrator will flat tell you, this is the short version, keep it up or go get the first book. And I will flat say that, or I will allude to something that happened in an earlier book and say, it's a really good story, but I don't have time to tell it right now. So I tell people, no, look at the earlier stuff. There was a note in the beginning of my original draft of Doubling Down that said, and I think I can quote myself correctly, this is a free country, or at least it used to be, so you can do what you want. But this novel is a sequel. I highly recommend reading door number 3 first. Good? Caught up now? Now we're doubling down. I loved it. Holmes looked at that and said, no, because that discourages anybody picking that book up from actually buying it right then. They think they have to go back and read something else first. They said they should. He said, no. Bad customer relations. You want them to be confused enough that they go back and buy number 1, but you don't want to discourage them from impulse buying number 2. And I thought about it and I realized, okay, his way is counterintuitive to my way of thinking, but he's been doing this for about 15 years, so he's probably right. Mm-hmm. Also, he's by publisher, which means he's right whether he wants to be or not. Just ask me about the revert more we had over my use of the Oxford comma. Oh, that was ugly. I got locked out of my own Google Doc, out of my own shared Google document, because we were reverting commas.
I will refrain and not ask who was on which side of the Oxford.
It was on the side of the Oxford comma. And Holmes, who grew up in New York, grew up reading the New York Times, which very famously does not use the Oxford comma. We drew reasons left over from the manual typesetting days, where they believed it was faster. But we're not in the manual typesetting days. Use the Oxford comma. Then he went back in and put in a whole bunch of extra commas in door number 3, some of which I still think are wrong. But again, he's the publisher,
I've got to say,
the publisher is never wrong.
Your titles are interesting. Where book 1 is door number 3, and book 2 is doubling down. I feel like book 3 needs to be something like,
Have you and Erin Paulette been talking? Because she said the exact same
thing. So funny thing, I talked to Alyssa Hazel, and she has a book called The Third Test. And now she's putting out the sequel called The Second Something. I don't remember how. And I mentioned, okay, book three needs to be the first something or whatever.
And it's not a bad idea, but here, and it also...
But then if you have, like, ideas for nine books, you can't keep going.
You can't. Some people, unless I find a way to start working negative numbers into titles.
Or fractioning.
Yeah, I could.
It's like,
half the distance to the goal line, half the distance to the goal line, eventually you end up at the subatomic particle distance, but you never get all the way there.
So book four would have to be, like, half a,
half and half
five or something. Yeah. Something to do with one half.
Door number three is titled, I originally just wanted to call it The Professor. And Holmes said, no, you can't do that because then, that introduces the character, but then what do you do for the sequels? Well, okay. And while we were writing while I was writing the back cover blurb, then the title came up to me. The company finds out where this 20-foot shipping container for the May is.
Uh-huh.
At this point, they have three options. Door number one, they can tell the feds. But then the feds are going to want to know how they know, and then the feds are going to start asking questions about the stuff that feds have been measuring to do. Door number two, they could call the state police there and drop a dime on them and let them deal with it. Or door number three, that they go after it themselves. So yes, it's a very subtle reference to Let's Make a Deal from the old days. But yeah, maybe I watched a few too many game shows in sick days, as a kid. But it's all written out in the blurb on the back cover of the first book. Door number three, they can, go for it themselves. And they open up door number three, which, to use Holmes' line, could get them all killed or worse. So that was what we went with. And then the second book, largely taking place in Las Vegas, doubling down, blackjack reference. Third book, I wanted to call it The Battle for Cell Phone Hill, as a homage to The Battle for Hunger Hill by then Lieutenant Colonel Dan Bulger. He's a former commander of mine who got me into grad school. I figured I owed him one. Holmes said it would take up too much space on the cover, so he just wants to call it Triple Play. But on the title page, I'm going to insist that we have Triple Play or The Battle for Cell Phone Hill. Because it's too good a title not to use, even if he thinks it won't fit on a cover.
Sounds
quiet.
Time will tell who is that man.
Maybe he'll listen to me. I sell enough books now that he thinks I have the occasional valid opinion. It's a bit more of a dialogue than me obeying order, phonetically obeying orders.
We should
write in process.
We should probably start wrapping up, but I know we have more time. We have more time on the clock here at the con, but my episode with the announcements at the beginning, it'll turn out a little long.
Cool.
But
I was a talker, man.
Yes. Yeah, I appreciate it. And I appreciate, I know you're Army, but you've got Marine Desert Pattern.
The funny thing, I'm curious about this one. Well, if you look, it doesn't have the EGAs in it.
True. Yeah.
This one was on the sale rack.
Well, why is it stand? Because the camera can't see the kilt you're wearing. So you've got the Marine Desert.
Also, my Canon Publishing 2 shirt.
Yeah.
With my nickname on it. It was a gift from Holmes for convention season last year. There's a great shot of us at LibertyCon with all of us in our Canon t-shirts and everything. And who knows? You might end up, if we fully recruit you, you might end up doing your own damn self.
I might.
Yeah. Hope so. But anyway, Dragon Con Dealer Hall in Atlanta, alcohol was involved because this thing was not cheap. Utility kilts are expensive, and even the sail rag kilts are expensive. But it was my size, and the color pattern wasn't quite what I wanted, but it was my size. I wanted one, and as I said, I'd been drinking, so I bought it. And I've gotten a lot of mileage out of it at conventions and whatnot over the last 13, 14 years I've had it. It still looks nearly new. It's either I mean, they wear it like adamantium. They're
one thing.
So I suppose in the long run, the investment paid off. But I do get mistaken for a Marine fairly frequently. Even if Army SOCOM also wore the Desert Digital, just without the EG. The order there's virtually from a Paraclete or... the Paraclete or a Terex, I don't remember which.
I have a pattern, a sewing patterns. And one of these days I'm going to get around to making it. I have a pattern for like an 18th century approximately style three-piece suit.
Nice!
And I figure I'll make my practice coat and vest out of old uniforms. No. So I figure I'm going to do desert pattern vest.
Nice.
And woodland pattern jacket.
Me, I sew as bad as I weld, so... calling what I do sewing is an offense to the art.
Yeah. Well, that's why I need a practice one, because
exactly.
I need very basic stuff.
Yep.
But before we go, I'd like to invite you to create a character for inclusion in my Nightshade Unicorn series. It'll be, this character will appear on page at least once.
Okay.
Doesn't have to be human. It could be an animal. I don't have elves and orcs and dwarves in this series. Sure. I have humans, I have unicorns, there will be dragons, and there are a few other magical creatures, jackalopes, and something I call faybirds.
A jackalope would be fun. And maybe a raccoon. Maybe a raccoon would be cool. A talking raccoon would be cool.
Okay. That's... Okay. I'll have to think about that.
It'd be an oversized talking raccoon, have a little bit of a weight problem, probably have a sore. Not a large sort of thing, but it's true.
Okay.
The slightly pudgy, nearsighted raccoon with a sword.
And
I like this.
So I told you before, I do reserve the right to modify the character to fit our world, but I like the idea, so I'll chew on it. Some form of this character will appear in the book.
Cool.
Or in the series. It might only be like, they see him down an alley once and that's it. But do you want to give...
Have cigars in your wound?
Name? I haven't.
You don't have tobacco? You don't have the any pipe weed on your planet?
I don't. I haven't officially decided that there isn't any such thing, but I...
Okay, well, maybe the raccoon will be smoked in a cigar then, but okay.
Do you want to give me any name or template for a name?
That's a good question. I don't think there'd be conventions for other species. I'll know him when I see him. I'll leave the name in your capable hands. But the raccoon, the pudgy got a sword. Does word last, so he didn't spell that well.
Okay.
He got it from you.
Okay. All right.
See, that's why I'm glad you're recording in video. That way I can work in all the sight gags.
Yeah. Yeah, and yeah. It'll be fun to work it maybe in a dream.
Okay.
I could.
It was a really bad pot of stew with the local inn, and he was reading about raccoons with his wounds.
Yeah. All right, well, thanks for coming on, and folks... Oh, where can people find you online?
I am Dan Kemp, author on Facebook. You can look for Dan Kemp Doubling Down or Door Number 3 on Amazon, and that will get you to the right spot. Basically, I have a social media footprint like a bomb going off. You'll find me somewhere.
All right, and we'll see you next time.
Bye, Naboda.